and carpeted with Persian silk carpets, embroidered with gold. Above, a kind of altar, and under a dais of blue velvet, surmounted by red and white plumes, there was a portrait of the size of life representing Anne of Austria, and so perfectly resembling her that D'Artagnan uttered a cry of surprise on seeing it. One would have believed that the queen was just about to speak. On the altar and under the portrait was the casket which contained the diamond studs. The duke approached the altar, and, after kneeling as a priest might do before the cross, opened the casket. "Here," said he, drawing from the casket a large piece of blue riband, all glittering with diamonds, "here are those precious studs with which I had made an oath to be buried. The queen gave them to me. She now takes them away. Her commands, like those of heaven, shall be obeyed in everything." Then he began to kiss, one by one, the diamonds, from which he was about to part. But suddenly he uttered a terrible cry. "What is the matter?" demanded D'Artagnan in alarm. "What has befallen you, my lord?" "All is lost," said Buckingham, becoming as pale as death. "Two of the studs are gone. There are but 10. Has your grace lost them, or do you suppose that they have been stolen?" "Someone has stolen them," replied the duke, "and it is the cardinal who has managed it. See, the ribbons which held them have been cut with scissors." "Has your grace any suspicion as to who has committed the theft? Perhaps the person has still got them." "Stop, stop," said the duke. "The only time I have worn these studs was at a ball at Windsor a week ago. The Countess de Winter, with whom I had been on cold terms, approached me during the ball. This appearance of reconciliation was really the vengeance of an offended woman. Since that day I have not seen her. That woman is an agent of the cardinal's." "What? Has he got agents then all over the world?" asked D'Artagnan. "Oh, yes," replied Buckingham, grinding his teeth with rage. "Yes, he is a terrible adversary. But yet, when will this ball take place?"
"Next Monday."
"Next Monday. 5 more days. It is more time than we shall need. Patrick!" exclaimed the duke, opening the door of the chapel. "Patrick!" His confidential valet appeared. "My jeweler and my secretary." The valet departed with a silent promptitude, which proved the habit he had acquired of blind and dumb obedience. But although the jeweler had been the first sent for, it was the secretary who, as he resided in the mansion, came first. He found Buckingham seated before a table and writing some orders with his own hand. "Jackson," said he, "you will go to the Lord Chancellor and tell him that I charge him with the execution of these orders. I desire them to be made public immediately."
"But, my Lord Duke, if the Lord Chancellor should question me about the motives which have induced your grace to adopt so extraordinary a measure, what am I to answer?"
"That such is my pleasure, and that I am not obliged to give to anybody an account of my motives."
"Is that to be the reply which he is to transmit to the king?" replied the secretary, smiling. "If, by chance, his majesty should have the curiosity to inquire why no vessel must weigh anchor in a British port?"
"You are right, sir," answered Buckingham. "He will, in that case, tell the king that I have decided on war, and that this measure is my first act of hostility against France." The secretary bowed and departed. "There, we may be quite easy on that point," said Buckingham, turning towards D'Artagnan. "If the studs have not yet gone to France, they will not arrive till after you."
"How so?"
"I have just laid an embargo on the ships at present in His Majesty's ports, and, without express permission, not one will dare to raise its anchor." D'Artagnan looked with wonder at the man who thus employed, in the service of his love, the unlimited power with which he was entrusted by the king. Buckingham saw, from the expression of his countenance, what was passing in the youth's mind, and smiled. "Yes," said he. "Yes, it is Anne of Austria who is my true queen. At her lightest word I would betray my country, my king, my God. She desired of me not to send to the Protestants of La Rochelle the aid that I had promised them, and she has been obeyed. I forfeited my word. But of what consequence was that whilst her will was gratified? Say, was I not nobly recompensed for my obedience, since it was to that obedience that I owe her portrait?" D'Artagnan marvelled at the fragile, unseen threads on which the destinies of nations and the lives of men may sometimes be suspended. He was immersed in these reflections when the jeweller entered. He was an Irishman, but one who was most skilful in his calling, and who confessed that he gained 100,000 livres a year by the Duke of Buckingham. "O'Reilly," said the Duke, conducting him to the chapel, "look at these diamond studs, and tell me what they are worth apiece." The goldsmith glanced at the elegant manner in which they were mounted, calculated one by one the value of the diamonds, and without hesitation replied, 1,500 pistoles each, my lord." "How many days would be required to make 2 studs like those? You see that 2 are wanting." "A week, my lord." "I will pay 3,000 pistoles each for them, but I must have them the day after tomorrow." "Your grace shall have them." "You are an invaluable man, O'Reilly, but this is not all. These studs must not be entrusted to anyone. It is necessary that someone should make them in this house."
"Impossible, my lord. I am the only person who can make them so that no one could discover the difference between the new and the old studs."
"Therefore, my dear O'Reilly, you are my prisoner, and even if you wished to leave my palace now, you could not. Tell me which of your workmen you want, and describe the tools which they must bring you." The jeweller knew the Duke, and that all remonstrances would be useless. He therefore made up his mind at once.
"May I inform my wife?" said he.
"Oh, you may even see her, my dear O'Reilly," said the Duke. "Your captivity shall not be harsh, I assure you. And as every inconvenience should have its recompense, here is a present of 1,000 pistoles, beyond the price of the 2 studs, to make you forget the annoyance you may experience." D'Artagnan could not recover from the surprise which he felt at the minister, who made such a profuse use of men and millions. As for the jeweller, he wrote to his wife, sending her the order for 1,000 pistoles, and requesting her to send him in exchange his most skilful apprentice, and an assortment of diamonds, of which he sent her the weight and description, along with a list of the requisite tools. Buckingham conducted the jeweller to the chamber prepared for him, which was, in 30 minutes, converted into a workshop. He then placed a sentinel at each door, with strict orders to allow no one to pass except his valet, Patrick. It need scarcely be added that O'Reilly and his assistant were absolutely forbidden to go out on any pretext whatever. This being arranged, the Duke turned to D'Artagnan. "Now, my young friend," said he, "England belongs to us too. What do you desire?"
"A bed," answered D'Artagnan. "I confess that at present that is what I stand most in need of."
Buckingham allotted D'Artagnan a room which adjoined his own. He wished to keep the young man at his side, not that he distrusted him, but that he might have someone to whom he could constantly talk about the Queen. An hour afterwards the order was posted throughout London that no ship would be permitted to leave the ports for France, not even the packet boat with letters. In everybody's opinion, this was a declaration of war between the 2 kingdoms. At 11 o'clock on the 2nd day, the diamond studs were finished, and so exactly imitated, such perfect facsimiles, that Buckingham himself could not distinguish the new one from the old. Even the most skilful in such matters would have been deceived as he was. He immediately summoned D'Artagnan.
"Here," said he, "are the diamond studs which you have come to fetch, and witness for me that I have done everything which human powers could accomplish."
"Rest assured, my lord, that I will truly represent what I have seen. But your grace gives me the studs without the casket."
"The casket would only encumber you. Besides, the box is the more precious to me, now that I have nothing else. You will say that I preserve it."
"I will perform your commission, my lord, to the letter."
"And now," said Buckingham, looking earnestly at the young man, "how can I ever repay my debt to you?"
D'Artagnan blushed, even to the white of his eyes. He saw the Duke wanted to find some means of making him a present, and the idea that his own blood and that of his companions should be paid for in English gold was strangely repugnant to him.
"Let us understand one another, my lord," said D'Artagnan, "and state the case fairly, that there may be no misconception. I am in the service of the King and Queen of France, and belong to the guards of Monsieur des Essarts, who, as well as Monsieur de Treville, is more particularly attached to their majesties. Everything that I have done has therefore been for the Queen, and not at all for your grace. And more than that, perhaps I should not have taken a single step in the affair if it had not been to please someone who is as dear to me as the Queen is to you.
Yes, said the Duke, and I believe that I know who that person...
My lord, I have not named her, said D'Artagnan quickly.
It is true, replied the Duke. I must therefore be grateful to that person for devotion.
Just so, my lord. For now that we are about to go to war, I confess that I see nothing in your grace but an Englishman, and consequently an enemy, whom I should be still more delighted to meet on the field of battle than in the park at Windsor or in the galleries of the Louvre. This, however, will not prevent me from executing every particular of my mission, and welcoming death, if need be, in its accomplishment. But I repeat to your grace that you have nothing more to thank me for in this second interview than for what I have already done for you in the first.
We say in our country, proud as a Scotchman, muttered Buckingham.
And we, answered D'Artagnan, say proud as a Gascon. The Gascons are the Scotchmen of Fra.
D'Artagnan bowed to the Duke and was about to take his leave.
Well, said the Duke, are you going in that manner? But what else will you take? How will you get off?
True. Egad, you Frenchmen
had nothing. I had forgotten that it is an island, and that your grace is its king.
Go to the port, ask for the brig, and give this to the captain. He will take you to a small harbour, where you will suspected, and where few but fishing go.
And the name is Saint-Valery.
But listen. When you are landed there, you will go to a wretched wine shop, without either name or sign, a true sailor's boozing ken. You cannot mistake it, for there is but one.
And then?
You will ask for the host, and you will say to him, Forward.
What does that mean?
It is the watchword which commands him to assist you on your way. He will give you a horse ready saddled, and show you the road that you must take. And you will, in this manner, find four relays upon your road. If you please, at each of them, to give your address at Paris, the four horses will follow you there. You already know two of them, and appear to have estimated them as an amateur. They are those which we rode, and you may trust me that the others are not inferior. These four horses are equipped for the field. Proud as you are, you will not refuse to accept one, and to present the three others to your companions. Besides, they are to help you in fighting against us. The end justifies the means, as you French say, do you not?
Yes, my lord, I accept your presents, said D'Artagnan, and, God willing, we shall make good use of them.
Now, give me your hand, young man. Perhaps we may soon meet on the field of battle, but in the meantime, I hope we part good friends.
Yes, my lord, but with the hope of soon being enemies.
Be contented. I give you my promise that we shall.
I depend upon your grace's word.
D'Artagnan bowed to the Duke and hastened towards the port.
Opposite the Tower of London he found the vessel to which he had been directed, and gave his letter to the captain, who got it countersigned by the governor of the port, and then prepared to sail immediately. 50 vessels were waiting, in readiness to sail. On passing one of them, side by side, D'Artagnan thought he saw the woman of Meung, the same whom the unknown gentleman had called my lady, and whom he himself had thought so beautiful. But thanks to the current and the favourable breeze, his vessel glided on so swiftly that in a few minutes it had left the others far behind. The next morning, about 9 o'clock, he landed at Saint-Valery. D'Artagnan immediately went to the appointed wine-shop, which he recognised by the outcries from within. The war between France and England was spoken of as certain, and the joyous sailors were making merry. D'Artagnan pushed through the crowd, approached the host, and pronounced the word, Forward. The host immediately made him a sign to follow him, went out by a door which led into a courtyard, conducted him to the stables, where there stood a horse, ready saddled, and then asked him whether he needed anything else.
"I want to know the road I am to take," said D'Artagnan. "Go from this place to Blangy, and from Blangy to Neufchâtel. At Neufchâtel, go to the tavern of the Golden Harrow.
Give the password to the innkeeper, and you will find, as here, a horse ready saddled.
Have I anything to pay? Asked D'Artagnan.
Everything is paid, said the host, and most liberally. Go then, and God protect you.
Amen, said the young man, as he galloped off. In 4 hours he was at Neufchâtel. Strictly following his instructions at Neufchâtel, as at Saint-Valery, he found a saddled horse awaiting him, and when he was about to transfer the pistols from the one saddle to the other, he perceived that the holsters were already duly furnished.
Your address at Paris?
D'Artagnan, Hôtel des Gardes, Compagnie des Essarts.
Very good,
answered the innkeeper. What road am I to take? Demanded D'Artagnan.
That of Rouen, but you will pass the town on your right. At the little village of Equy you will halt. There is but one tavern, the French Crown. Do not judge of it from its looks, for it will have in its stables a horse of equal value with this.
The same watchword?
Exactly.
Adieu, master.
A good journey, sir. Do you require anything else?
D'Artagnan said no by a shake of his head, and went off again at full speed. At Equy, the same scene was enacted. He found a host equally well prepared, a horse equally fresh and ready. He left his address as before, and departed in the same way for Pontoise. At Pontoise he changed his horse for the last time, and at 9 o'clock he entered the courtyard of Monsieur de Treville's hotel at full gallop. He had got over nearly 60 leagues in 12 hours. Monsieur de Treville received him just as though he had seen him the same morning, only pressing his hand a little more warmly than usual. He informed him that the company of Monsieur des Essarts was on guard at the Louvre, and that he might repair to his post. 22. The Ballet of the Merlaison. The next morning nothing was talked of in Paris but the ball which the magistrates were to give to the king and queen, and in which their majesties were to dance the famous ballet of the Merlaison, which was the favorite ballet of the king. For the last week every preparation had been in progress at the Hôtel de Ville for this important entertainment. The city carpenter had erected scaffolding on which the ladies who were invited were to be seated. The city chandler had furnished the rooms with 200 wax lights, which was an unprecedented luxury at that time, and 20 violins had been engaged at double the price usually paid, on the understanding that they were to play throughout the whole of the night. At 10 in the morning, the Sieur de la Coste, ensign of the King's Guards, followed by 2 officers and many archers of the Guards, came to demand of Clermont, the city registrar, all the keys of the gates, chambers, and closets of the hotel. These keys were given to him immediately, each bearing a label indicating to what it belonged, and from that moment the Sieur de la Coste had the superintendence of all the doors and avenues. Duhallier, the captain of the guards, came in his turn at 11 o'clock, and brought with him 50 archers, who stationed themselves immediately at the respective doors which had been assigned to them in the Hôtel de Ville. At 3 o'clock there arrived 2 companies of guards, one French, the other Swiss. The company of French guards was composed of equal numbers of the troops of Monsieur Duhallier and of Monsieur des Essarts. The company began to arrive at 6 o'clock, and were at once conducted to the places prepared for them in the grand saloon. The lady of the first president arrived at 9 o'clock. As she was, next to the queen, the most distinguished individual of the entertainment, she was received by the gentlemen of the city, and conducted to a box opposite to that of the queen. At 10 o'clock a collation of sweetmeats was prepared for the king, in the small room on the side of the Church of Saint-Jean, before the city's sideboard of silver, which was guarded by 4 archers. At midnight loud cries and multitudinous acclamations resounded through the streets. It was the king who was proceeding from the Louvre to the Hôtel de Ville, along thoroughfares illuminated throughout their length by coloured lamps. The magistrates, clothed in their robes of cloth, and preceded by the sergeants, each holding a torch in his hand, hastened to receive the king, whom they met upon the steps, where the provost of the merchants complimented and welcomed him, to which his majesty replied by excuses for the lateness of his arrival, for which he blamed the cardinal, who had detained him till 11 o'clock, discoursing on affairs of state. His Majesty, in full dress, was accompanied by His Royal Highness the King's brother, the Count de Soissons, the Grand Prior, the Duke de Longueville, the Duke de the Count Roche-Guyon, Monsieur Count de Bar, the Count de Cramay, and the Chevalier de Souveray. Everyone remarked that the King looked preoccupied and unhappy. A closet had been prepared for the King, and a second one for his royal brother. In each of these closets were laid out masquerade dresses. A similar preparation had been made for the Queen and for the President's lady. The lords and ladies in their Majesty's suite were to dress themselves, two by two, in apartments set aside for that purpose. Before he entered his closet, the King desired to be apprised of the Cardinal's arrival as soon as it had taken place. Half an hour after the arrival of the King, fresh acclamations resounded. These announced the arrival of the Queen. The magistrates went through the same formalities as before, and, preceded by their sergeants, advanced to meet their illustrious guest. The Queen entered the room, and it was remarked that, like the King, she looked sad and also weary. The moment that she entered, the curtain of a small gallery, which had till then been closed, was opened, and the pale face of the Cardinal appeared, clothed as a Spanish cavalier. His eyes fixed themselves on those of the Queen, and a smile of terrible joy passed across his lips. The Queen was there without her diamond studs. Her Majesty remained for a short time, receiving the compliments of the city gentlemen, and answering the salutations of the ladies. Suddenly the King appeared, with the Cardinal, at one of the doors of the saloon. The Cardinal spoke to him in a low voice, and the King was very pale. The King broke through the crowd, and without a mask, and with the ribbons of his doublet scarcely tied, approached the Queen, and in an agitated voice said, "Madam, wherefore, I pray you, have you not on your diamond studs, when you knew that I wished to see them?" The Queen looked around her, and saw behind the King, the Cardinal, smiling with a satanic smile. "Sire," replied the Queen, in an agitated voice, "because amidst this great crowd I feared some accident might befall them." "There you were wrong, madame. I made you this present in order that you might adorn yourself with it. I tell you that you were wrong." The voice of the King trembled with anger. Everyone looked and listened with astonishment, not at all understanding this extraordinary scene. "Sire," said the Queen, "I can send for them from the Louvre, where they are, and thus the wishes of your Majesty will be accomplished." "Do so, madame, and that immediately, for in 1 hour the ballet will begin." The Queen bowed submissively, and followed the ladies who were to conduct her to her closet. The King also retired to his. There was a momentary excitement and confusion in the saloon. Everyone could perceive that something had occurred between the King and Queen, but both of them had spoken so low that, as all had kept at a respectful distance, no one had heard anything. The violins played most strenuously, but no one attended to them. The King left his closet first. He wore a most elegant hunting dress, and his brother and the other nobles were dressed in the same costume. This was the kind of dress most becoming to the King, and, thus habited, he truly seemed the first gentleman of his realm. The Cardinal approached the King and gave him a box, in which His Majesty found 2 diamond studs. "What does this mean?" demanded the King. "Nothing," answered the Cardinal. "Only, if the Queen has the studs, which I must doubt, count them, sire, and if you only find 10, ask Her Majesty who can have robbed her of these 2. The King looked at the Cardinal as if to ask what this meant, but he had not time to put any further questions. An exclamation of admiration from every lip. If the King appeared to be the Queen was indisputably the most beautiful woman in France. It must be allowed, of course, that her costume of a huntress fitted her most charmingly. She wore a beaver hat with blue feathers, a robe of pearl-grey velvet fastened with diamond clasps, and a skirt of blue satin embroidered with silver. Over her left shoulder glittered the studs, suspended by a bow of the same colour as the feathers and the skirt. The King trembled with joy, and the Cardinal with anger. Yet, distant as they were from the queen, they could not count the studs, and although the queen had them, the question was, were there 10 or 12? At this moment the violins sounded the announcement of the ballet. The king advanced with the president's lady, with whom he was to dance, and his royal highness with the queen. They took their places, and the ballet began. The king figured opposite the queen, and, as often as he passed her, he looked devouringly at the studs, which he could not manage to count. A cold moisture hung upon the cardinal's brow. The ballet lasted an hour. There were 16 figures. At its conclusion, amidst the applause of the whole assemblage, everyone conducted his partner to her place. But the king profited by his privilege to leave his partner where she was, and advanced quickly towards the queen.
"I thank you, madame," said he, "for the deference you have paid to my wishes. But I believe you have lost 2 studs, and I bring them to you."
At these words he offered her the 2 studs which he had from the cardinal.
"What, sire?" cried the queen, affecting surprise. "Give me 2 more? What will make me hack me in?"
Counted them, and found the 12 studs upon her majesty's show. The king summoned the cardinal.
"Well, what does all this mean, cardinal?"
demanded the king in a severe tone.
"It means, sire," answered the cardinal, "that I wished her majesty to accept these 2 studs, but not daring myself to make her the offer, I have adopted this method."
"And I am the more grateful to your eminence," replied the queen, with a smile that proved she was not the dupe of this ingenious gallantry, "as I am certain that these 2 studs have cost you more than the other 12 cost his majesty." Then, having curtsied to the king and the cardinal, the queen took her way to the chamber where she had... She was to now remove her ball costume.
This is the end of disc number 7. Please insert disc number 8. This is disc number 8.
Then, having curtsied to the king and the cardinal, the queen took her way to the chamber where she had dressed, and where she was now to remove her ball costume. The attention which we have been obliged to bestow upon the illustrious personages introduced at the commencement of this chapter has diverted us for a time from him to whom Anne of Austria was indebted for the unprecedented triumph which she had just gained over the cardinal, and who, obscure, unknown, and lost amidst the crowd at one of the doors, contemplated from that station a scene which was incomprehensible to all but 4 persons, the king, the queen, the cardinal, and himself. The queen had returned to her apartment, and D'Artagnan was going to retire, when someone lightly touched his shoulder. He turned and saw a young woman who made a sign that he should follow her. This young woman wore a black velvet mask, but in spite of that precaution, which, after all, was taken more against others than himself, he immediately recognized his ordinary guide, the gay and witty Madame Bonancieux. They had met on the previous evening, but only for an instant, at the lodge of Germain, the Swiss, where D'Artagnan had inquired for her. The anxiety of the young woman to communicate the good news of her messenger's fortunate return to the queen prevented the 2 lovers from exchanging more than a few words. On this account, D'Artagnan followed Madame Bonancieux, influenced by the double sentiment of love and curiosity. During their progress, and as the corridors became more deserted, he endeavoured to stop the young woman, to touch her and to gaze upon her, were it but for a moment. But, quick as a bird, she glided between his hands, and, when he wished to speak, she placed her finger on her lip, and, with a slight gesture of command which was full of grace, reminded him that he was under the dominion of a power which he must blindly obey, and which interdicted even the least complaint. After a few turns, Madame Bonancieux opened a door, and pushed the young man into a closet, which was quite dark. There she again enjoined silence, and opening a 2nd door concealed in the tapestry, through which a brilliant light emanated, she disappeared. D'Artagnan remained an instant motionless, and wondering where he was. But shortly a ray of light which penetrated into this chamber, a warm and perfumed air which reached him, and the conversation of two or three women, in language at once respectful and elegant, in which the word majesty was frequently repeated, clearly indicated to him that he was in a closet adjacent to the queen's apartment. The young man kept himself in the shade and listened. The queen appeared gay and happy, which seemed greatly to astonish the ladies who surrounded her, who were accustomed to see her almost always full of care. The queen attributed this joyous feeling to the beauty of the fete, and to the pleasure which she had experienced in the ballet. And, as it is not allowable to contradict a queen, whether she smiles or weeps, everyone expatiated on the gallantry of these aldermen of the good city of Paris. Although D'Artagnan did not know the queen, he soon distinguished her voice from those of the others, first by a slight foreign accent, and then by that tone of command usually characteristic of the speech of sovereigns. He heard her approach and retire from that open door, and once or twice saw the shadow of her person intercept the light. Suddenly, however, a hand and arm of an adorable form and colour were passed through the tapestry. D'Artagnan comprehended that this was his reward. He threw himself upon his knees, seized this hand, respectfully pressed his lips upon it, and then it was withdrawn, leaving in his what he soon recognized to be a ring. The door was immediately shut, and D'Artagnan was again left in complete darkness. He put the ring upon his finger, and once more waited. It was evident that all was not yet ended. After the recompense of his loyalty should come the recompense of his love. Besides, although the ballet had been danced, the entertainment was scarcely yet begun. The supper was to take place at 3, and the clock of St. John had, a short time before, already struck a quarter to 3. By degrees, in fact, the sound of voices diminished in the neighbouring chamber, and the ladies were then heard to leave it, after which the door of the cabinet was opened, and Madame Bonancieux entered quickly. "You come at last!" cried D'Artagnan. "Silence!" said the young woman, putting her hand upon his lips. "Get out again, the same way you came." "But where and when shall I see you?" cried D'Artagnan. "A note, which you will find at your lodgings, will tell you. Go, go." And at these words she opened the door of the corridor and pushed D'Artagnan out of the cabinet. He obeyed like a child, without resistance or even objection, which proves that he was very positively in love. 23. The Appointment. D'Artagnan ran the whole of the way home, and although it was 3 in the morning, and he had to pass through the worst parts of Paris, he met with no misadventure. There is known to be a particular deity for drunkards and lovers. He found the door in the passage open, ascended his stairs, and knocked gently, in a way agreed upon between him and his servant. Planchet, whom he had sent back 2 hours before from the Hôtel de Ville, to wait for him, came and opened the door. "Has anyone brought for me a letter?" eagerly inquired D'Artagnan.
"No one has brought a letter," said Planchet, "but there is one which came of itself."
"What do you mean, stupid?"
"I mean that when I came in, although I had the key of your apartment in my pocket, and although this key had never been out of my possession, I found a letter on the green cover of the table in your bedchamber."
"And where is that letter?"
"I left it where it was, sir. It is not natural for letters to enter gentlemen's rooms in this manner. If, indeed, the window had been found open, I should say nothing, but it was hermetically closed. Take care, sir, for there is certainly some magic in it."
In the meantime, the young man had rushed into his chamber and opened the letter. It was from Madame Bonancieux, and expressed in these terms. "Warm thanks are to be given and transmitted to you. You must be at Saint-Cloud this evening, at 10 o'clock, opposite the pavilion, which stands at the angle of Monsieur d'Etrée's house. C.B." On reading this letter, D'Artagnan felt his heart dilating and contracting in that delicious spasm which is the torture and delight of lovers. It was the first note he had received, the first appointment that had been granted to him. His heart, expanding in the intoxication of his joy, felt as though it would faint at the portal of that terrestrial paradise which is denominated love.
"Well, sir," said Planchet, who had seen his master's colour come and go, "was I not right? And is not this some wicked transaction?"
"You are mistaken, Planchet. And the proof is, here is a crown for you to drink my health."
I thank you, sir, and will strictly follow your directions. But it is not the less true that letters which thus enter closed houses fall from heaven, my friend, fall from heaven. Then you are happy, sir?
My dear Planchet, I am the happiest of men.
And I may take advantage of your happiness and go to bed.
Yes, go.
May all heaven's blessings fall upon you, sir. But it is not the less true that this letter...
And Planchet retired, shaking his head with an air of doubt, which all the liberality of D'Artagnan had not been able entirely to remove. As soon as he was left alone, D'Artagnan read his note over and over again, and kissed at least 20 times these lines traced by the hand of his beautiful mistress. At length he retired to bed, and slept, and was visited by golden dreams. At 7 o'clock in the morning, D'Artagnan arose and called Planchet, who at the second summons opened the door, his countenance yet bearing traces of his uneasiness on the previous evening. "Planchet," said he, "I am going out, probably for the whole day. You are therefore free till 7 o'clock in the evening, but you must be ready at that hour with 2 horses.
"Well," said Planchet, "I suppose we are going to have our skins pierced again in a few places."
"You will take your carbine and pistols."
"Well, then, did I not say so?" exclaimed Planchet. "There, I was sure of it. That cursed letter!"
"But be easy now, simpleton. It is only a party of pleasure."
"Yes, like that most delightful journey the other day, when it rained balls and grew caltrops."
"If you are afraid, Planchet, I will go without you. I like better to travel alone than with a timid companion."
"You insult me, sir," said Planchet. "I thought, however, that you had seen me at work."
"Yes, but I suppose that you expended all your courage on that one occasion."
"You shall see, at a fitting time, that some yet remains. Only I entreat you not to be too prodigal of it, if you wish it to last long."
"Do you think that you have got still sufficient to spend some this evening?"
"I hope so."
"Well, then, I depend upon you."
"At the hour appointed, I will be ready. But I thought there was only one horse in the guard stables."
"Perhaps there may be only one there at present, but in the evening there will be 4.
"It seems as if our journey was an expedition to provide fresh horses for ourselves."
"Exactly so," said D'Artagnan, and, giving Planchet a last warning gesture, off he went.
Bonancieux was at his door, and D'Artagnan designed to pass by without speaking to the worthy mercer. But the latter accosted him so politely and kindly that the tenant was obliged not only to bow in return, but also to enter into conversation with him. How, indeed, was it possible not to display some slight complaisance towards the husband of a pretty woman who has just made an appointment with one at Saint-Cloud's, opposite the pavilion of Monsieur d'Etrée, for that very evening? D'Artagnan approached him, therefore, with the most amiable manner that he was able to assume. The conversation naturally turned on the poor man's imprisonment, and Monsieur Bonancieux, not knowing that the young man had overheard his conversation with the man of Meung, related the persecutions of that monster Monsieur de Laffemas, whom he styled throughout the whole of his narrative the cardinal's executioner, and discoursed freely concerning the Bastille, the bolts, the dungeons, the air-holes, the grates, and instruments of torture. D'Artagnan listened with the most exemplary attention. Then, when he had ended, "And Madame Bonancieux," said he, "do you know who carried her off? For I do not forget that it is to that vexatious occurrence that I owe the happiness of your acquaintance."
"Ah," answered Monsieur Bonancieux, "they took good care not to tell me that. And my wife, on her part, has sworn by all that's sacred that she did not know. But you yourself," continued Bonancieux, in a tone of the most perfect good fellowship, "what has become of you for the last few days? I have never seen either you or your friends. And it was not on the pavements of Paris, I should suppose, that you picked up all the dust which Planchet brushed off your boots last night."
"You are right, my dear Monsieur Bonancieux. I and my friends have been making a little journey."
"Was it far from here?"
"Oh, Lord, no, merely about 40 leagues. We went to conduct Monsieur Athos to the waters of Forges, where my friends have remained."
"And you have come back, have you?"
resumed Monsieur Bonancieux, with the most spiteful look possible.
A handsome youth like you cannot get long leave of absence from his mistress. And you were impatiently expected at Paris, were you not, huh?
Faith, said the young man, laughing, I confess it the more willingly, my dear Monsieur Bonancieux, as I perceive that I can conceal nothing from you. Yes, I was expected, and most impatiently, I assure you.
A slight shade passed over Bonancieux's countenance, but it was so slight that D'Artagnan did not perceive it.
"'And you are about to be rewarded for your diligence?'
continued the mercer, with a slight alteration of voice, which D'Artagnan did not perceive, any more than the cloud which had passed a moment before over the face of the worthy man.
"'I hope you may prove a true prophet!' exclaimed D'Artagnan, laughing.
"'My reason for accosting you,' continued Bonancieux, "'is merely to learn whether you will return late.'
"'Why this question, my dear landlord?' asked D'Artagnan. Is it because you intend to wait for me?
No, it is because ever since my imprisonment and the robbery which was committed on me, I am frightened every time I hear a door opened, and particularly at night. By Our Lady, I cannot help it. I am no soldier, truly.
Well, do not be frightened if I enter at 1, 2, or 3 o'clock in the morning, or even if I do not enter at all.
Bonancieux became so pale at this that D'Artagnan could not but observe it, and asked him what was the matter.
"'Nothing,' replied Bonancieux. "'Nothing. Only since my misfortunes I am subject to these feelings which seize me on a sudden and make me shudder. Don't trouble yourself about that, you who have enough to occupy you in your approaching happiness.'
"'Oh, I am occupied in my present happiness.'
"'Not yet. Wait a little. You said that it should be tonight.'
"'Well, the night will come, thank God, and perhaps you also may expect it as impatiently as me. Perhaps this evening Madame Bonancieux intends to visit the conjugal home.'
"'Madame Bonancieux is not disengaged this evening,'
gravely replied Bonancieux.
"'She is detained at the Louvre by her official duty.'
"'So much the worse for you, my dear landlord. So much the worse. When I am happy myself, I should like all the world to be so, too. But that appears to be impossible.'
And the young man went off, laughing loudly at the joke, which he alone, as he imagined, could comprehend.
"'Laugh as you like,' said Bonancieux in a sepulchral tone.
But D'Artagnan was already too far off to hear him. And if he had heard him, in the disposition of mind in which he then was, he would not have heeded him. He went towards the hotel of Monsieur de Treville, his visit of the evening before having been, as it may be remembered, very short and very little explanatory. He found Monsieur de Treville in the heartiest joy. The king and queen had been most gracious to him at the ball. The cardinal, it is true, had been very ungracious. At 1 o'clock in the morning he had retired, under the pretext of indisposition. As to their majesties, they had not returned to the Louvre till 6 in the morning.
"'Now,' said Monsieur de Treville, lowering his voice and looking cautiously around the room to be sure that they were alone, "'now, my young friend, let us talk of yourself, for it is evident that your safe return is connected with the king's joy, the queen's triumph, and his eminence's humiliation.' "'You must take care of yourself.'
"'What have I to fear?' answered D'Artagnan, "'so long as I have the good fortune to enjoy their Majesty's favour.'
"'Everything, believe me. "'The Cardinal is not the man to forget being made a fool of, "'at least until he has settled accounts with the person who has made a fool of him. "'And that person seems to me to be a certain youth of my acquaintance.'
"'Do you believe that the Cardinal has got so far as you have, and knows that I am the individual who has been to London?'
"'The devil! You have been to London? And is it from London you bring that beautiful diamond which glitters on your finger? Take care, my dear D'Artagnan. The present of an enemy is not a good thing. Is not there a certain Latin verse upon the subject? Stop a moment.'
"'Yes, undoubtedly,' said D'Artagnan, who had never been able to knock the first rule of the rudiments into his head, and who had driven his preceptor to despair by his ignorance. "'Yes, undoubtedly, there must be one.'
"'Yes,' said Monsieur de Treville, who had a small amount of learning. "'There is one, certainly,
and Monsieur Benserade was quoting it to me the other day. Wait a moment. Here it is. Timeo Danaos et dona ferentes, which means distrust the enemy with a present in his hand. This diamond does not come from an enemy, sir, replied D'Artagnan. It comes from the queen. From the queen? Said Monsieur de Treville. Truly, it is a complete royal jewel, which is worth 1,000 pistoles, as fully as it is a single farthing. By whom did the queen send it to you?
She handed it to me herself.
Where was that?
In the closet adjoining the apartment where she changed her dress.
How?
In giving me her hand to kiss.
And you have kissed the queen's hand?
Said Monsieur de Treville, looking at D'Artagnan. Her Majesty did me the honor to grant me that favor.
And in the presence of witnesses? Imprudent, doubly imprudent.
No, sir, no one saw her, replied D'Artagnan. And he related to Monsieur de Treville how everything had occurred.
Oh, women, women! Cried the old soldier. I recognize them well by their romantic imaginations. Everything which is at all mysterious charms them. Then you saw the arm, and that was all. You might meet the queen and not recognize her. She might meet you and not recognize you.
No, but thanks to this diamond, replied the young man.
Listen, said Monsieur de Treville, will you allow me to give you some advice, some good advice, a friend's advice?
You will do me the honor, sir, replied D'Artagnan.
Well, then, go to the first jewelers you can find, and sell this diamond for what he will give you for it. However great a miser he may be, you will get at least 800 pistoles. The pistoles have no name, young man, but this ring has a terrible one, which might destroy him who wears it.
Sell this ring? A ring given me by my sovereign? Never!
Then turn the stone within, poor simpleton. For everyone knows that a Gascon youth does not find such gems in his mother's jewel case.
You suspect, then, that I have some cause for fear? Said D'Artagnan.
I mean to say, young man, that he who sleeps over a mine, when the match is lighted, ought to think himself in safety in comparison with you.
The devil, said D'Artagnan, whom Monsieur de Treville's serious tone began to disturb.
The devil! And what am I to do? Above all things, be always on your guard. The cardinal has a tenacious memory and a long arm. Believe me, he will play you some trick.
But what?
Has he not at his command all the wiles of Satan? The least that can happen to you will be an arrest.
What? Would they dare to arrest a man in his Majesty's service?
Egad, they did not scruple much in the case of Athos. At any rate, young madcap, believe a man who has been 30 years at court. Do not slumber in your security, or you are lost. On the contrary, I warn you to see enemies everywhere. If anyone seeks to pick a quarrel with you, avoid it, even if it should be but a child of 10 years of age. If you are attacked by night or day, beat a retreat without being ashamed of it. If you pass over a bridge, try the planks for fear one should break beneath your feet. If you walk past a house which is being built, look up in the air, lest a stone should fall upon your head. If you come home late, let your servant follow you, and let him be armed, if even you can make sure of your servant. Distrust everybody, your friend, your brother, and your mistress, but your mistress most of all.
D'Artagnan blushed. My mistress, he mechanically repeated. And why her more than anyone else?
Because a mistress is one of the favorite agents of the cardinal. He has no one more expeditious. A woman sells you for 10 pistoles, witness Delilah. You know the scriptures, eh?
D'Artagnan thought of the appointment which Madame Bonancieux had made for that very evening. But we must say, to the praise of our hero, that the bad opinion which Monsieur de Treville entertained of women in general did not inspire him with the slightest suspicion of his pretty landlady.
"But apropos," resumed Monsieur de Treville, "what has become of your three companions? I was just going to inquire whether you had not received any tidings of them."
"None whatever, sir."
"Well, I left them behind me on my way. Porthos at Chantilly, with a duel on his hands, Aramis at Crèvecoeur, with a bullet in his shoulder, and Athos at Amiens, under an accusation of passing bad money."
"Look there, now," said Monsieur de Treville. "And how did you escape yourself?"
"By a miracle, sir, I ought to confess, with a sword thrust in the chest, and by pinning the Count de Wardes on his back on the road to Calais, as one might pin a butterfly upon the tapestry."
"There again! De Wardes, one of the cardinal's men, and a cousin of Rochefort's. Come, my dear friend, an idea has struck me."
"Speak, sir."
"In your shoes there is one thing that I would do."
"What is it?"
"Whilst his eminence was seeking for me at Paris, I would take, without sound of drum or trumpet, the road to Picardy, and would endeavour to find out what had become of my three companions. Surely, in any case, they merit this slight attention on your part."
"The advice is good, sir, and tomorrow I will go."
"Tomorrow? And why not this evening?"
"This evening, sir, I am detained at Paris by an affair of importance."
"Ah, young man, some little love affair. Take care. I repeat it once more. It is woman who has always ruined us, even from the beginning, is ruining us, and will still ruin us to the end. Be advised by me, and depart this evening."
"Impossible, sir."
"Have you given your word?"
"Yes, sir."
"That is another matter. But promise me that, if you are not killed tonight, you will set out tomorrow."
"I promise you."
"Do you want money?"
"I have 50 pistoles remaining. It is as much as I shall require, I think."
"But your companions?"
"I think that they can be in no want. We left Paris each with 75 pistoles in his pocket."
"Shall I see you before your departure?"
"I think not, sir, unless anything new should occur."
"Well, a good journey to you."
"Thanks, sir." And D'Artagnan took his leave of Monsieur de Treville, more than ever touched by his paternal solicitude for his musketeers. He went successively to the homes of Athos, Porthos, and Aramis, but none of them had returned. Their servants were also absent, and nothing had been heard of either masters or lackeys. He might possibly have gained some tidings of them from their mistresses, but he knew not those of Porthos and Aramis, and Athos had none. In passing the Hotel of the Guards, he looked in at the stables. 3 of the 4 horses were already there. Planchet, quite astounded, was busy currying them, and had already finished 2 out of the 3.
"Ah, sir," said Planchet, "how glad I am to see you!"
"And why so, Planchet?" demanded the young man.
"Can you depend on Monsieur Bonancieux, our landlord?"
"I? Not in the slightest degree."
"And you are quite right, too, sir."
"But why do you ask the question?"
"Because, whilst you were talking to him, I looked without listening, sir, and his countenance changed colour 2 or 3 times.
"Bah!
You did not observe it, sir, preoccupied as you were by the letter you had just received. But I, on the contrary, who had been put on my guard by the strange manner in which this letter had got into the house, did not let one change of his countenance escape me."
"And what did you discover?"
"That he is a traitor."
"Really?"
"And, moreover, the moment you had turned the corner of the street, Monsieur Bonancieux took his hat, shut his door, and began to run in an opposite direction."
"Upon my word, you are quite right, Planchet. All this looks suspicious enough. But be contented. We will not pay him 1 farthing of rent till all this is satisfactorily explained."
"You joke, sir, but you will see."
"What would you have, Planchet? That which will happen is written."
"Then, sir, you do not renounce your expedition this evening?"
"On the contrary, Planchet, the more I dislike Monsieur Bonancieux, the more inclined I am to keep the appointment made in this letter, which disturbs you so much."
"Then it is your determination?"
"Immovably so, my friend. Therefore, at 7 o'clock, be ready here at the hotel, and I will come and find you." Planchet, seeing there was no hope of making his master renounce his project, heaved a profound sigh, and set to work grooming the 3rd horse.
As for D'Artagnan, who was fundamentally a young man of great economy, instead of going to his own home, he went and dined with the young Gascon priest, who, during the temporary distress of the four friends, had given them a breakfast of chocolate. 24. The Pavilion. At 9 o'clock, D'Artagnan was at the Hôtel des Gardes. He found Planchet under arms, and the fourth horse arrived. Planchet was armed with his carbine and pistol. D'Artagnan had provided himself with his sword and placed two pistols in his belt. They each bestrode a horse and went off quietly. It was a dark night, and none saw them depart. Planchet followed his master at the distance of 12 paces. D'Artagnan passed over the quays, went out by the gate of La Conférence, and proceeded along the charming road, far more beautiful then than now, which leads to Saint-Cloud. As long as they continued in the town, Planchet kept the respectful distance that he had fixed for himself. But when the road became more lonely and obscure, he gradually drew nearer, so that when they entered the Bois de Boulogne, he found himself quite naturally riding side by side with his master. In fact, we must not deny that the waving of the trees and the reflection of the moon amongst the sombre copses caused him much uneasiness. D'Artagnan perceived that something extraordinary was incommoding his lackey. "Well, Planchet," demanded he, "what ails you now?"
"Do you not find, sir, that woods are like churches?"
"And why, Planchet?"
"Because one is as much afraid of speaking loudly in the one as in the other."
"Why dare you not speak loudly, Planchet, because you are in fear?"
"Yes, sir, in fear of being heard."
"Fear of being heard? Our conversation is very proper, my dear Planchet, and no one would find anything in it to censure."
"Ah, sir," replied Planchet, returning to the ruling idea in his mind, "that Monsieur Bonancieux has a sly gloom about the eyebrows, and something so unpleasant in the working of his lips."
"What the plague makes you think so much of Monsieur Bonancieux?"
"Sir, we think of what one must, and not of what one would."
"Because you are a coward, Planchet."
"Let us not confound prudence with cowardice, sir. Prudence is a virtue."
"And you are very virtuous, are you not, Planchet?"
"Is not that the barrel of a musket, sir, shining below there? Suppose we were to stoop our heads."
"Really," muttered D'Artagnan, who remembered the advice of Monsieur de Tréville, "really, this animal will finish by making me afraid." And he put his horse at a trot. Planchet followed his master's movements, precisely as if he had been his shadow, and soon found himself trotting by his side.
"Must we travel in this manner all the night, sir?" demanded he.
"No, Planchet, for you are at your journey's end."
"What? I am at my journey's end? And you, sir?"
"I shall go some little way farther."
"And leave me here alone, sir?"
"Are you afraid, Planchet?"
"No, but I will merely observe to you, sir, that the night will be very cold, that cold causes rheumatism, and that a lackey who has the rheumatism makes but a sorry servant, especially to such an active master as yourself."
"Well, then, if you are cold, you can enter one of those wine shops which you see down there. But you must be waiting for me before the door at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning."
"But, sir, I have most dutifully eaten and drunk the crown that you gave me this morning, so that I have not got even a stray sou remaining in case I should feel cold."
"There is half a pistole. Goodbye, till tomorrow morning." D'Artagnan got off his horse, threw the bridle to Planchet, and hurried away, closely enveloped in his cloak.
"Good God, how cold I am!" exclaimed Planchet, as soon as he had lost sight of his master.
And, eager as he was to warm himself, he hastened to rap at the door of a house which had all the appearance of a suburban dram shop. In the meantime, D'Artagnan, who had taken a narrow crossroad, reached Saint-Cloud. But instead of proceeding along the main street, he turned behind the castle, went down a narrow, unfrequented lane, and soon found himself opposite the appointed pavilion. It was situated in a perfect desert of a place. A long wall, at the corner of which was the pavilion, ran along one side of this lane, and on the other a hedge hid from the wayfarer a small garden, at the bottom of which there stood a miserable cottage. He had now reached the place of appointment,
and as he had not been told to announce his presence by any signal, he waited. Not a sound was heard. He might have fancied himself 100 leagues from the capital. D'Artagnan cast a glance behind him, and then leaned his back against the hedge. Beyond this hedge, and garden, and cottage, a heavy mist enveloped in its shade that vast immensity where Paris slept, an immensity void and open in which some luminous points glittered like the funereal stars of that vast pandemonium of suffering and sin.